White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Tonight, Thursday, May 16th, 2013, we are covering Chapter 42, and it is our 47th episode. I'm Carolyn Yeager,
and I am Hadding Scott.
And it just so happens that tonight's chapter ends Volume 2, as I'm sure you're well aware, Hadding. But there are four volumes in this great classic of Henry Ford's, and so we're at the halfway point, which is kind of exciting. And you know, we're also in our 1 year anniversary week, so it makes a rather nice little neat package that, we should finish half of the book in this first year, which means we have another year to go, although probably not quite. Before we complete the book and consider what else, the next thing we should read, I think we might also do something of a review of what we have learned so far. I'm not saying right this minute, but maybe next week or something. It's always good to do things like that rather than just kind of let it fly off and forget too many things. Review, you know, some of the things that have been brought very close to home is the power of the Jews is undeniable and seemingly unassailable, considering that many of the things that the international Jew thought could be accomplished back in their time were not, and things have only gotten worse. So, and we also know for sure that Jews are only out for their own interests, and I'm sure there's more points we could come up with. Do you have one off the top of your head?
Not really.
Well, we might...
The discussion about the Jewish control of media, of entertainment and information is pretty important.
Well, it is. And I think this power of the Jews is what we need to get across, not just to our own people, but to... white people, our own, you know, people who are already Jew-wise, as it said, but to all white people, all American people, all European people, it just doesn't seem like it should be so hard to get that across, except that they will point to people, the people who want to get it across as being, you know, anti-Semites, Nazis, this, that, and the other thing. So that's what makes it difficult, but this is what we need to get across because it's so obvious. So we might talk about some of that coming up. I think we should. We might bring up some of that on the 27th. What is that? This coming Monday? You're going to be doing the Heretics Hour this coming Monday.
Yes, right, so I'm told.
Yes. You are. I hope you're working on it. And then the following Monday, the last Monday of the month, I think it is, you and I and Tan Stoffel will be on talking about the White Network and so on. And we could bring that up then. I think I'm going to make that one of the topics that I'll bring up. So, so tonight's chapter is a good one. As I already said, it ends the volume two of the four-volume work and is kind of divided into two parts. So we're finishing up the first half of this, which maybe they thought that was all they would do, and then they went on and kept going and did twice as much again. I mean, another same amount again. But it's called The Present Status of the Jewish Question. So they're summing it up themselves in this chapter, what's gone before, right?
Well, yes, I think so.
Yeah, I think so. All right, so do you want to...
All righty. Chapter 42, The Present Status of the Jewish Question. The Jewish question in the United States has existed for years, but until now in silence and suspicion. Everyone knew that there was such a question. The Jew himself knew best of all, but very few possessed the courage to open the question to the sanitary influences of sunlight and speech. The mention of courage in this connection is needful to explain the silence. A few men of insight have attempted publicly to define the question in the United States, and they have been so effectually dealt with by an invisible power of which the public could have no knowledge, that free speech on the Jewish question naturally became unpopular. The fact, it is true, reflects far more seriously on non-Jews than on Jews, but it is a fact nevertheless. He who undertakes to speak truth on this question must expect far more opposition than he could ever withstand were he not speaking the truth. And I just want to mention that this fear of speaking the truth seems to be more of a problem in the United States than it was in Germany. And I think it's because of our individualism in this country. The whole country is founded on individualism. You know, life, well, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
Oh, well, yeah, you mean even back then. Yeah, I was going to say, well, when the, you know, after 1945, they had all that to use against, you know, speaking the truth about the Jews, but you, that's not when it started. It's even at this time, Americans were,
well, the United States was
ignorant, naive.
The United States of America was founded on bourgeois liberal ideas. That's mm-hmm. that's individualism. Mm-hmm. That condition has gotten worse as time has gone
well,
by.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole idea of freedom. You know, it's all this, we've worshipped freedom. I mean, I grew up worshiping freedom and lived most of my life worshiping freedom because I thought that was the highest ideal. And, of course, freedom's great, but well, like with everything, there's a lot to be said about, you know, about things like that.
It has to be responsibility as well.
Well, sure, yeah. That's
one fact that militated against free speech on the Jewish question was the condition into which our American people have been trained of expecting applause and approval to follow every act and word. There was a time in American history, and it was the most glorious period of our past, when opposition was considered an often desirable attitude. A man's weight was accounted equal, whether computed by the number of his enemies or his friends. But a softening change has come over us. We have grown to like applause. Hisses used to stir our fathers. Hisses cow their sons. Public speech has thus grown flabby. The press has thus become neutral. We have grown pudgy and futile in our program of helping the weak. So pudgy and futile that we no longer have gristle to attack the strong who have brought weakness upon the others.
Well, that's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And, you know, people didn't used to fall apart every time somebody looked at them sideways or called them a name. And certainly people in public life didn't. They, you know, they rose to the occasion and they had good debates and so on. But, right, if you think about these politicians today, and of course they're all scum, but compare them to so much other, there were, they weren't all great people in the past, but, you know, compare them to much of what existed in the past is pathetic. They run and hide from every little thing. They just want to be popular.
Yes. Well, that can be traced to a couple of factors that come to my mind. One is the tendency for people to grow up being sheltered from conflict and hardship more and more, which is something that Adolf Hitler highlighted.
Yes.
And another thing.
He sure wasn't.
If you go back to Thomas Jefferson thought that freedoms like freedom of speech depended on the people who were supposed to exercise those speeches being economically self-sufficient. In other words, they should all be farmers. The electorate in general should be self-sufficient farmers for this popular self-determination idea to really work. And we've gotten far, far away from that. Not so much in 1920 as today. It's much worse today. But even then, it was a trend away from people living on farms.
Oh yeah, and on top of that, not only don't they live on farms, or are they independent business people of any kind, but they're all, half of the people that we have now are on welfare, and they're just, that's their way of life, you know. So what are they going to be doing? You know? I'm glad you brought this up, babe. People today being so sheltered from hardship, because it's really on my mind, because I just posted at my website, CarolynJaeger.net, something I've been, more of this Willy Wenger material, and it is the the diary reports of his brother Leopold, who did a lot of biking. Now, we're talking about 1936 and 1937. And just, you know, it's not the most exciting stuff, I guess, but I really like it, like reading it. And I learned that at 14 years old, he made his first bike trip, you know, with a couple of friends, several days. And then when he was 15, he made a whole bunch of them. And he was so independent, and he was so strong, and he could take care of everything himself, you know, and he had such good manners, and he was so responsible. And they were always cleaning up their sites, and they were respectable. They loved their country. It was their country. They thought of it as their country. So they took care of everything. These kids, he especially was such a wonderful example compared to the kind of thing that we raise up today. And you know, you're right about being sheltered. I mean, and of course, back then, again, the situation was different, where you didn't have people praying and criminals and perverts and everything around every corner, where kids could go out and do these things and nothing bad ever happened to them. You know, they were just amongst their own people. But now we have a society where parents have to shelter their kids and not let them out of their sight until they go to college or something. And it's just, we're just being ruined. We're being ruined. Anyway, got on a rant there. But I hope people will go and take a look at that.
As a people, we have passed the bunk around so habitually.
Yeah, but isn't that supposed to be buck? I changed it to buck from bunk.
It says bunk.
I know it does, but I think that's a mistake.
We have enervated our judgment and moral convictions so seriously by our fake philosophy of boost. We have become so accustomed to measure the effectiveness of work by the applause it immediately provokes that we have lost all stomach for courses that call for contest. Unless it be those spurious contests of the political arena, which are all managed from the same great headquarters, or those verbal assaults against big business, which bring no reaction. We have lost all taste for tangible foes who have a ready retaliation. And you can hear that in some of this right-wing rhetoric that refers to corporate media instead of Jewish media.
Yeah.
You'll hear that on Republic Broadcasting. Nevertheless, it is true that, whereas a year ago it was not possible to speak the word Jew in the United States, it is now possible. The name appears on the front page of every newspaper nearly every day. It is the subject of discussion everywhere. For the time, at least, speech has been liberated, although our friends of the B'nai B'rith in every state are doing their best to throttle it. This freedom is of benefit both to Jew and non-Jew. the Jew need no longer look askance at the name of his race on the lips of a non-Jew. It only means that suppression and deceit are past. That is all. The Jew is a Jew, is recognized as a Jew, is spoken of as a Jew, and thus an honest relation between the mind and the fact is established in both the Jew and the non-Jew. The air is cleared. Concealment, on the one hand, is done away. On the other hand, a missing fact, whose absence meant confusion, is supplied. The Jew may now say, "I am a Jew," as casually as any other man might claim his race. We may even see some noted Americans who all their lives have tried to conceal their race come forward now and say, "We are Jews." It is freedom to the Jew. It is interpretation to the non-Jew. Half the confusion which men meet in their efforts to account for the world is due to their ignorance of just where the Jew is. He is always a key. But if the key is disguised, if the key be disguised as something else, how can it be used?
Well, you know, I had a thought here that they're talking about kind of like the Jews coming out, you know, coming out in the open instead of hiding. I don't know how accurate that all that is. But I thought, well, how do you compare that to homosexuals coming out? It's not in our best interest for homosexuals to come out, or unless we are going to deal with them. And it's the same way. I don't know if it's in our best interest for Jews to come out unless we're going to really deal with them. But I guess I don't have a very good case there. I'm not sure what that all comes to. All right, sorry.
Well, I suppose one of the disadvantages to this candor about the Jews is that they're in a position to glorify themselves and propagandize openly on their own behalf, you know, and have, you know, premillennialist Christians take free trips to Israel and so forth.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
I mean, if it's going to make it all good, you know, rather than be examined, like, you know, if like homosexual coming out, there's no examination of the effect on our society. It's just, oh, isn't it wonderful? Oh, yeah, you know, they don't have to hide it anymore. They're just human beings. So, you know, this is this thing where people are this is supposed to be, I guess, another aspect of freedom where their real role, their detrimental role, is not being looked at.
I think this is trying to put a good face on the matter as far as it how it affects Jews, because if the Jews exist as a parasitic group in the country, of course they don't want the attention. You know, they don't want to be identified. They don't want to be spotlighted. Doesn't help them. There might be some Jews that feel, you know, that they're not interested in all that, and they don't want to have to go along with it. Like this Carl Bernstein came out a few days ago and said that it was Zionist Jews that pushed for the invasion of Iraq. Famous Jewish journalist Carl Bernstein did that. Maybe he feels liberated.
Well, I agree with you that what the international Jew is doing here is their usual, every so often, trying to show that they just want to bring all these questions out in the open, and then it'll be better for everybody, Jew and non-Jew, and we'll all, you know, solve these problems. They're constantly doing that, but it hasn't turned out that, because the Jews don't cooperate. They don't want to solve any problem, they don't want to tell the truth either.
So. About 8 months ago, the Dearborn Independent began a series of studies on the Jewish question. It was an attempt to state the facts on which the question is based. It was not at its beginning, nor has it since developed into, an attack on Jews as Jews. Its purpose was enlightenment, And if it secretly indulged a hope, it was this, that the leaders of American Jewry might be wise to see that this is the country and this is the time in which the causes of distress and distrust and disrepute might be removed from Jewry, and a genuine modus operandi, not of toleration, but of reconciliation, arrived at. The proof that these articles have contained facts, and only facts, is found in the failure of the Jewish spokesman to show any one of them to be false. The record stands that way, not one disproof. The reason for the record is this: when only facts are sought and are subjected to the tests, only facts are found. If, however, one embarks on a campaign whose purpose is to besmirch an opponent or create a prejudice, one's partisan zeal may induce him to accept as facts what is merely probability. And I think they fell down a little bit in that regard, where the protocols are concerned.
I know you do, but you know, I think this is they're making a real good point here, that both sides have to cooperate, and the Jews don't cooperate in these efforts at bringing forth the facts and, you know, shining the light on things. That's one of the major traits that they have as a group.
These articles, however, do not constitute a campaign. They are the lighting of lamps here and there about the country, in this industry and that, in corners heretofore kept dark by those who should serve more faithfully on the watchtower of the press. What the Dearborn Independent has said could have had no weight at all had not the people been able to see the same facts all about them. It is not information, but illumination, that has given these articles the importance that they have found among hundreds of thousands of readers. The Jewish response to these articles has in one way been gratifying, and in another way, quite disappointing.
Well, you know, they mentions here, you know, that hundreds of thousands of people are reading these Dearborn Independent articles that have become chapters in this book that we've been reading. Were they being taken seriously, or were they reading them because they were given out by the Ford dealerships and so on? And do you even know if they read them? But, you know, kind of making out that this word was really getting out at this time. But then something happened. And it wasn't convincing people, because they have a hard time not, you know, feeling that they're being anti-Jewish.
Jewish response has been gratifying in that it has furnished substantial proof of all the statements made in the Dearborn Independent. This journal has no doubt of the truth of its statements, and is possessed of a very substantial reserve of evidence. But nonetheless, the corroborative evidence produced by the Jewish leaders themselves in endeavoring to meet the issue is appreciated. There is no reason to believe that this was an intentional contribution on the part of the Jewish leaders. It was simply impossible for them to move without revealing further evidence. It is quite well known what is the position of Jewish leaders today. It is one of fear. For once they themselves are possessed with the fear of the unknown. For once. Knowing how much of the truth exists behind the statements made in this series, they are in fear of what may yet come forth. They do not even make any more pretense of considering it a joke. In their own conclaves, they do not rave and roar like the rabbinical editors. they behave themselves like sober, frightened men, who sometimes have a desire to own up to some of the things that have been charged, but who are halted by a doubt as to how far the owning up process would lead them if once begun. They are in fear of the truth, but mostly of the whole truth.
I think that's very good.
Needless to say, a responsibility rests also on those who hold the whole truth. The purpose determines everything. If the purpose is to breed hatred of the Jews, that involves one course of action. If the purpose is to excite the public mind with startling facts, that involves another course of action. There is a certain danger in certain kinds of information. If the purpose is to lay a basis for an intelligent, straightforward understanding and possible solution of the question, then such information as defines the question and presents all essential material is all that is necessary. It is within these limits that this series has endeavored to keep. If there are facts which are unfavorable to the Jews, that is a matter for the Jews. If the Jews do despite to a certain class of facts, it may be necessary to produce still another class of facts. If the leaders of the Jews had been fair, just argumentatively, oppositionally fair, they would not now be in fear of what may yet be produced. Jews, for illustration, have proved the statement that they are the best organized people in the United States. They have proved that they are more closely grouped together in their own national interest than are the citizens of the United States, whose whole nationality is defined by their citizenship. The government of the United States itself is not so well organized as American Jewry, and that fact is not due to anything American. It is the same in every country. Telegraphic speed and instantaneous mass action have marked every move organized Jewry has made in this country in the last 6 months. It is not for nothing that they control the avenues of communication in this country. It is not for nothing that the wireless of the world is under ironclad Jewish control, means radio broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. So they decided radio was already under Jewish control in 1920.
Well, I guess at that point it would have been point-to-point communication and beginning broadcasting. I'm not sure exactly when broadcasting began, but it was not too long before this publication date.
Well, they must, I don't know what, I'm not familiar with what was going on then in radio, so, but they're saying without any, you know, ifs, ands, or buts, that it's under ironclad Jewish control.
They are not loosely organized in social lodges for occasional fellowship. They are organized as states of the Jewish people, with officials who do nothing whatever but attend to the advancement of Jewish power in this and other countries. They have proved by the mass play of their synagogues, their newspapers, their alleged social organizations, their conservative clubs, and their Bolshevik socialist groups, all of them working together under orders, that they are a separate people within the American people, a people that do not agree with the genius of the American people, and a people that constantly make distinctions between Jewish and American rights. Well, that's significant that he says there are all of them working together under orders, that he's talking about a conscious conspiracy.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's an alternate explanation, which is evolutionary psychology.
Yeah, I know. Well, I go along with this one, that there, it's a conspiracy, and that it, and it is, it's, a lot of it is shown, or it fits a lot what we see in the protocols. And so.
Well. Okay. In every state, in every city, there is a Jewish organization with a definite policy. And the first policy is to suffocate, destroy, put the fear of the Jew upon any man, newspaper, or institution that gives the least indication of independent thought on the Jewish question. These organizations have special committees to do certain work. One of these works is to start a whispering drive against the person or institution aimed at. This whispering drive is a most hideous oriental device. It can be sustained only by groups of minds which bear a certain racial twist. Without giving a full description of the devices used, it can be seen that the fact of their being centrally controlled and working simultaneously in all parts of the country creates a considerable force. No other institution now operating in the United States can accomplish that so quickly and unitedly.
You know, I'd like to add, I can't quite see how evolutionary psychology somehow crosses out that these people use conspiratorial methods and that they conspire to do what they're doing. How does it negate that?
It doesn't negate it. It just makes it, that the explanation redundant. You don't have to assume that Jews doing the same thing in different places at the same time means that they all planned it that way, because it's in their genes to behave a certain way.
Well, but the international Jew here is, as you pointed out, saying that they're under orders. So
yeah, that's probably not a necessary claim.
Okay.
You know, although they did have the Jewish, they did have that Kahila, they did have the American Jewish Committee. You know, so there was organization.
Oh, my God, there was organization. There's so much organization with Jews, and it goes way back, too.
But
I mean, they're
nothing
but organization.
It doesn't have to be all monolithic in order to explain Jews doing
I don't really see why you want to keep making that point, as though, you know, you don't want people to see the Jews.
Because the explanation based on evolutionary psychology is scientific, and the claim.
Well, there's no denial of evolutionary psychology that I can see in anything that I believe or people who would go along with this. I don't see any that there would be any denial of those writers of the International Jew or Henry Ford of evolutionary psychology. Why would they you know be in conflict?
Well, I was going to say, evolutionary psychology is scientific, but the claim of a monolithic conspiracy is a kookery, all right?
Well, you're just afraid of kookery. I know that. You always use that word kookery.
No, I've never used it.
You got some, oh, well, you do with me. You have with me a lot. So that's, you just got something about that I don't know why, since conspiracy is so absolutely documented, all over the place, why you think conspiracy is kookery. But, you know, we're getting...
The claim of a monolithic conspiracy is...
Well, who's talking about... I don't know. When you add that word monolithic, you're adding something that's not here. Monolithic sounds like something huge. Well, we'll have to... Maybe we can talk about this when we do that program on Monday. We'll have so many things scheduled for that program. We won't be able to get it all in. We better continue here.
Jewish solidarity would be above criticism were it used for the benefit of the whole communal life. But it is not. It is not only Jewish, but its operations show it to be largely anti-American. This does not mean anti-American in the sense of being pro-German or pro-Mexican, but in this sense, that it opposes many things that have been conceded to constitute the American tradition. The Jew assumes that the United States is still an unformed entity, which is fair prey to any man who can seize it and mold it. That is his attitude today. He refuses to assume that America is here. He adopts the belief that part of his duty is to bring America into being, on Jewish lines, of course. Now, in a sense, the United States is private property. It is the property of those who share the ideals of the founders of the government. And those ideals were ideals held by a white race of Europeans. They were fundamentally Christian ideals. And with most of these, the Jews not only disagree, but hold them in contempt. Indeed, a Jewish leader recently said in New York that the United States was not a Christian land, and the context of his statement showed that he clearly intended that it should never be. He was condemning the Christian Sunday, though he is an officer of a society whose purpose is the establishment of the Mosaic Sabbath.
Wow, I wish they'd name that Jewish leader. It's probably somebody's like, I can't think of that judge's, that, no, he's not, he wasn't a judge, that lawyer's name. One of those big, big, well-known heads of these organizations. You know, that they say something that the United States is not a Christian land. I wonder what they are basing that on.
The Jews have also proved the charge that they exercise disproportionate influence in governmental affairs. This charge has only been stated in this series. The mass of proof has not yet been brought to bear, but it exists, fixed beyond all change. However, another important bit of evidence has been transpiring before the country's eyes. When the immigration bill was first put up to Congress, the vote was overwhelming in favor of restricting entry into the country. Congress voted upon the facts and its patriotic convictions. Taking the question just as it was, no other verdict could have been given. Hardly had the vote been taken, however, than the wires were hot and the trains crowded and Jewish protests and Jewish agents began flocking to Washington. The magic name Jew was uttered. Legislators fled to cover. Learned speeches were made. Compromises were suggested. Modifications of the original law were framed. Under the magic of Jew, the whole proposal simply melted like an icicle before a fire. The only protest made against that congressional vote was made by Jews. Their wonderful teamwork in all parts of the country gave their protest the air of national importance. But there was one point the Jews were not able this year to deny, and that is that the majority of the immigrants are Jews. That fact, fortunately, was established beforehand. The hand of the Congress of the United States was stayed by the Jews in a matter of serious importance to national protection. Just as a few years ago, the hand of the Congress of the United States was forced to break the treaty with Russia, when President Taft held it would be wrong to break it. This proof of political power, based on nothing but sheer force and sheer determination to have what they want, regardless of what the United States wants, has appeared broadcast as a matter of public knowledge. And let the reader mark this. It will be found that this present immigration move is as much a part of the Jewish world program as was the breaking of the treaty with Russia. Readers of the article of January 15th will recall how, at the behest of the Jews, the United States trade with Russia was thrown into the hands of German Jews, who were using it to further their plans for the destruction of the Russian Empire, which later came to pass. The Jews used the United States to put across an essential part of that plan. Well, what are they using the United States for now? We may well believe that the Jews are not without several reasons for what they are doing. The Jew excels as a chess player because he plays a game wherever he may be. The immigration matter amounts to this. Jews are streaming out of Poland as speedily as they can. It is not pogroms that are driving them out. Pogroms have been proved to be immigration propaganda for consumption outside Poland. The Jews are leaving Poland because they know something is going to happen. And if they are leaving Poland, it is a sign that it is going to happen to Poland. And if the Jews have advanced news of it, it is a sign that what will occur will be inflicted by the Jews. Plainly, it is this. Jewish Bolshevism in Russia has made a secret decree against Poland. The Jews are getting out of the way. American Jewish agents are constantly passing into Poland. Rich American Jews are sending agents to bring back groups of relatives. There is an exodus from Poland, and there is a reason for it which spells trouble for Poland. The United States is being used as the chief means by which the Jews are to clear out. France protests against them and will not have them. England most decidedly refuses to have them. The Jews of the United States are powerful enough to compel this country to take them. We were utilized to effect the entrance of Bolshevism into Russia. It went from our east side thither, it means the east side of New York. We are now being utilized to assist at the destruction of Poland. It is possible, however, that by the time the Jewish program reaches that point, something may have intervened. The Jews of the United States have also given a splendid illustration of what the Dearborn Independent said of their control of American newspapers. Of course, the local newspaper editor is not dominated by any Jewish authority seated at Washington, New York, or Chicago. Of course not. But he is very amenable to the 20 richest Jews in his community who advertise in his paper, and it is they who take orders from Washington, New York, and Chicago.
Well, there you go. Do you disagree with that, that they're taking orders from their centers of power, from their major big organizations? And the editor gets his orders from Jewish headquarters, even though he doesn't realize it.
Well, you know, there are different Jewish organizations in the country. They have...
They all work together. They're all like one big thing with different names, like that multi-headed hydra or whatever it is. You know, one big monster with all these heads.
I think their cohesion is primarily due to being heavily inbred.
Okay.
So the editor gets his orders from Jewish headquarters just the same, though he may not realize it. Yeah. This, however, is one instance where publicity does not count, because it represents a business favor oftener than it does an editorial conviction. The knowledge of the Jewish question, which newspaper men possess, is quite complete, and a confidential counsel of the best informed editors of the United States would include all that the government or the people would need to know for a complete handling of the Jewish question. The publicity demanded and received by the organized Jews has proved a roarback. It has served the cause of truth more than the cause they desired, which was suppression.
I looked up roarback. Yeah. I thought it must be a mistaken spelling. But no, it's real. It's a false or slanderous story for political advantage.
Yeah. Originally in reference to James K. Polk.
Right.
Gratifying as these proofs are to the producers of the facts, there is a very decided element of disappointment in the Jewish answers. Either Jewry is fainting or is defenseless. Certainly the present status of the defense must be humiliating to those who have any conception of the importance of the matter. The answer signed by the Jews themselves, a list of signatures which showed, as in panorama, the close-locked corporational solidarity of the Jewish race in this country, was devoid of a single fact which threw light. In this, the Jewish answer was almost a confession of no defense. But aside from its ineptitude was its utter lack of frankness. It refuses to face the question. It will not meet a single statement, either in the substance of the protocols or in the substance of this series. It veers off whenever it approaches a concrete theme, and loses itself in a vapor of denials. If a statement is wrong, it is provably wrong, especially a statement which deals with matters now actual in daily life. The official Jewish answer signed by a Jew, the official Jewish answer signed by a few, not all, of the Jewish leaders, is at least decent in its language. And that is more than can be said for most of the other Jewish answers. But it is indecent in its attempt to create the impression that anti-Semitism is abroad in the country. Mark this. All the anti-Semitism that exists in the United States today is the deliberate creation of the Jewish leaders, and is a recent creation. We certainly saw that with the Leo Frank case.
Right.
Essentially, no anti-Semitism in Georgia until the Jews tried to keep Leo Frank from facing justice. That turned a lot of Georgians against the Jews because they saw what was happening. The Jewish leaders want anti-Semitism here. Unable to create it among non-Jews, they are seeking the effects of it among the Jews by telling them that it exists.
Hmm.
So he's saying that anti-Semitism actually helps the Jews. It helps them maintain cohesion.
Yeah. That's something also that should be taught and explained to people who don't understand it. And, you know, it's like what I wrote down here, they want a Holocaust, too. And which is the ultimate anti-Semitism, and they sold the Holocaust to the Jews first, and then the Jews convinced Gentiles by their belief in it and their stories and, you know, all the stuff they made up, thinking that, well, it really happened, even though it didn't quite happen like that to them, but it must have happened to other people so they can tell it too.
The Jewish leaders of the United States have done everything possible to keep the Dearborn Independent away from the Jews, to prevent their reading it and learning the facts that no attack is being made on the Jews as Jews. From the first, after wrestling for weeks to discover a way of meeting these articles without having to confess too much, these leaders threw up their hands and took refuge in the lie of anti-Semitism. What they ought to fear now is not the force of an anti-Semitic feeling among the non-Jews, but the force of a righteous indignation among American Jews when they discover the deceit and incompetence of their leaders. Anti-Semitism has always been the last resort of scoundrelly Jewish leaders when cornered by the truth, and they have been known deliberately to incite it among the Gentile rabble in order, through it, to maintain their hold on their own people. Recently, there was printed in the newspapers a protest against anti-Semitism, signed by various non-Jews. The protest was printed twice, in fact, because it did not go big the first time. The newspapers were evidently growing a little weary of printing daily communiques from Jewish great headquarters. So, to give it more vim for a thorough circulation, the signature of Woodrow Wilson was obtained. And, of course, that put it on the telegraph wires again. It was quite proper for President Wilson to sign a protest against anti-Semitism. It was quite proper for all the other signers to do so, provided that was what they meant to do. If the protest had been sent to the Dearborn Independent, its responsible officials would have signed also. The Dearborn Independent is against anti-Semitism and protests against leading Jews using its name to foment that spirit. The protest, however, innocent the signers may have been of this fact, was against any public discussion of the Jewish question, and especially against this one.
That's really interesting, that they're not protesting anti-Semitism. They're protesting people talking about the Jews.
Yeah. Protest against criticism.
Yeah.
The dispatches are careful to state that the Jews had nothing to do with that protest. A supposedly non-Jewish organization has been in the service of a coterie of New York Jews for a long time. The assertion that the protest was written by a single citizen, a non-Jew, acting upon his own initiative and responsibility and without consultation with anybody is mildly amusing. There was just enough consultation to make the whole non-Jewish protest nothing more nor less than a previously approved document, and the citizen who did the job has known for a long time where it pays to please. As to Mr. John Spargo, whose name is beginning to appear prominently as a Gentile defender of the Jews, this much is known. He did not undertake the Jewish defense without several secret consultations with a group of New York Jews, who had to overcome several of Spargo's scruples before they could make much headway with him. Spargo's attitude was something like this: "Gentlemen, they've got it on you. It's not a matter that can be whitewashed." Spargo told a lot of truth in that New York room. The Jewish conferees knew it was truth. If Spargo should speak 1/20th as much truth on the platform, his lecture engagements would dwindle in number. All of the literature of the Anti-Defamation Society, all of the speech of the retained defenders, is very welcome. Open the question up. If the Jews engage enough Gentile defenders, the time will come when Gentile logical faculties will bring about a real discussion of the question. The Jewish spokesmen must, on pain of losing their position, limit themselves to denials, abuse, and threats. But the Gentile defenders are constitutionally unable to dwell in that state of mind for long. They will probe through to the truth. in which event real discussion may be expected. There is not a single Jewish publication, however vituperative and truthless, that we would forbid the mails or exclude from a public library. There is not a single Jewish spokesman whom we would heckle or hinder on the public platform. There is not a single Jewish enterprise that we would recommend for boycott. We believe in free speech and unfettered conviction. By means of these, the people may yet hope to clean up the United States. The Jews do not believe in free speech. They do not believe in a free press. In every state in the Union, the B'nai B'rith is introducing into the local legislatures a bill that will prevent any publication from saying anything derogatory of the Jews. That is the Jews' answer to the facts produced in this publication. In scores and hundreds of libraries, the Jews are using the members of their race who happen to be on library boards, or are using committees of their race to influence library boards, to clear the libraries of all books, pamphlets, and papers that deal with the Jewish question in a manner to leave any doubt that the Jews are paragons of virtue and the chosen people. This is occurring in the United States. It is occurring in some of those Eastern American states that stood most valiantly for the cause of free speech and a free press in other days. Let it go on. Multiply the instances. Add madness to madness. Each act of this nature simply gives a local proof, visible and intelligible to each community where it transpires, that what is written about the Jews is true. The present status of the Jewish question in the United States is this. A beginning has been made on the too long accumulating facts. Jewish recognition of the truth has been expressed in soberness among the leaders. Jewish action in response has been, for themselves, denial. For others, suppression. The result to date is abject failure to meet the case.
All right. Well, we've got 60 seconds to comment on that. This was 29 January 1921. You know, I think they're trying here as they close down their, 40, well, I don't know how many chapters that they've already written. To put things in perspective and to get a little bit tough here, you know, even though they start out trying to be, still trying to be somewhat conciliatory. But do you think they succeeded in putting across anything here that's...
Well, I think when you say that we believe in free speech and the Jews don't, there's never going to be any end to the people that say, you know, that don't believe in the free speech. You can't shut them up as long as you say, we believe in free speech. You know, we don't believe in shutting down these people that don't believe in free speech. They'll just keep at it and they'll continue to be a nuisance.
Well, you're right. That's pretty good. You know, I think we have to, I don't think we can give them the rights that we give ourselves. We have to change that. That's my opinion. Well, ladies and gentlemen, come back next week.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.